Hi, welcome back to A Life Economy, dedicated to exploring the intersection of technology, spirituality, and consciousness. We're your hosts, Cosmo Scharf
and Summer Berry.
And today we are blessed to have Tiffany Stevens on the podcast. Welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah, awesome. So we are in a very interesting moment right now. Today is November 6th, 2020, a few days after the election. And it is still not called yet officially in this moment, but we anticipate, you know, having a result maybe later today or perhaps tomorrow. What's your take on where we are right now? How are you feeling?
I don't know. I'm very nervous. I mean, as we were just talking about, we're just constantly refreshing the page to see. I mean, I definitely think Biden's going to win. But I just want to see the handover. That's what I'm really excited about, to just see how graceful our current president is going to be when he leaves office.
Mm. Yes, I've been refreshing the various news outlets today and the past few days. And it's kind of funny because over the last few years, I've deliberately held off and really deleted all the news apps and not paying attention to the news. But I need to know. And it's they're really dragging this season finale out.
Truly, truly. Yeah. And it's a finale we've been waiting for 4 years. So
right.
Yeah, it's crazy.
I'm interested in your perspective as, I guess, are you a first generation American or?
That's a tricky question. My mom is French Vietnamese and my dad's American.
Okay.
My dad grew up in New York and then left after college and moved to Hong Kong. So I'm this weird thing where, like, I grew up in Asia, but I live in America, but I have the citizenship, but I don't know what it's like to grow up here. So my perspective is still quite third party. And sometimes I can, you know, it's really, I don't know. I go through an identity crisis every day and I really don't know if I fit into that demographic.
Right.
Yeah. I have no idea.
That's really interesting.
Yeah.
Because you're like half first generation, half second generation. If someone's good at fractions, they can do the math on that for us. But that's really interesting. And what were you going to say?
Yeah, well, I noticed on your various social profiles, you have quadruple citizenship. So that's definitely a unique status that you have.
Very unique. That I give all the credit to my parents for making sure I was set up in Europe, in America, and in Asia. So being able to work anywhere in the world is very, very lucky. And it's all them.
Wow. So, yeah. So it's of course here, Europe, you mentioned, and where else?
So here, France, because my mom's French, Vietnam, and Hong Kong.
Wow. Very international. So in case things go crazy here, you have many places to go to.
Sure. But I'd much rather be here though.
Yeah.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
For sure.
Gosh, there's just so much, like, as a storyteller, having the option to possibly choose these locations for films you may make, or just to have the perspective of someone who's had such an international life, to be able to add that to your storytelling is like amazing, especially being a young woman. How do you feel your multicultural background has influenced your storytelling?
You know what? I'm glad you think that it's cool, but I want to say for the most part, a lot of people in Hollywood are quite insular and only like hearing stories that they relate to. So me being such a complete anomaly outsider, people are actually not very interested because they're like, well, I can't relate. You don't hold the same perspective as me. So I don't care about your story. And that I find is a general, like, overarching theme in American culture in general. So as much as I'd love to be like, hey, look at how awesome and unique I am, a lot of it is me having to like shift gears towards creating a narrative that people can actually relate to and empathize with and see themselves projecting into whatever those characters are.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So what would you like to do with that realization? Like, how do you want to fit that in to your, bless you, to your storytelling, your as a filmmaker? And what do you want to say? How does that make you feel? And like, what do you think people need to know based on that?
I think if anything, like, people need exposure and perspective. And I'm going to be the person to try and give it to them in the most psychologically like hard-hitting way. People often ask me, like, the big question I get is, what is the most culture shocking thing about America when you first move here? What is the big thing that like really, really pushed you off guard? And for me, it's the idea that politics are like absolutely considered taboo. Like, it's just the thing you don't bring up at the dinner table. You don't talk about what you believe in. You just don't talk about that. And what was really weird to me is that it just doesn't make sense. It doesn't. Like, you're blessed to live in like a democratic republic where you have free speech. Like, whereas, you know, Hong Kong is pretty much communist. So you don't have that same kind of freedom and you have a lot of censorship from the government. And so I think that it's extremely important for more Americans to talk politics, regardless of their political preference, because it's so important to just communicate and gain perspective. And, you know, I mean, despite the whole pandemic going on, I have actually taken this year to travel and see the country, which I know a lot of people are going to judge me for because I'm spreading or whatever, but I'm negative and I was in a car the whole time. So whatever, just shouting out that. But yeah, you know, I mean, I've lived in this country for 7 years and all I saw was California and New York. And the 2016 election was just the biggest blindside for me because I was so convinced Clinton was going to win. Just because, again, all I knew was California and New York. I was like, there's no way in hell. Like, I completely forgot about all the red states. I didn't even think about the red states. I didn't even try to like empathize and try and see things from their perspective. I was just like, no, Clinton's going to win. And obviously so wrong. And that really made me want to get to know this country. And so this year I was like, you know what? It's the perfect year. I can just, gas is cheap. Go on a road trip. Saw the Southwest, saw New England, just got back from the South like two days ago.
Amazing. Where did you go?
In the South?
Yeah.
We started in Texas, then we did Oklahoma, Arkansas, Tennessee, Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana.
Amazing.
I've never been to any of those places in my life.
Yeah, it was fucking awesome. And it gave me a lot of context as to what is going on in this country. And all I can say is that, you know, I feel like I've been living in such an LA bubble, and it's just really eye-opening to see what other states have to say politically about what's going on. And I think, you know, more than anything, like, regardless of political party, people are going to vote for the candidate that makes their personal lives better.
Yeah.
You know, like, their everyday. People don't think globally. People don't think about international relations. They just think, how can I make it to tomorrow? And at the end of the day, you really can't fault a person for being self-serving in like a capitalist cash grab country, you know? Like, at the end of the day, like, people don't know any better. People know what it's like to live elsewhere, and people just don't want to have their taxes increased. They just can't afford to, especially with this unemployment rate. And, you know, as much as I love living in a capitalist society and a capitalist republic, there are definitely still flaws, but that's like a whole different conversation. And the thing is, like, you can't fault a person for that, but what you can fault them for is a lack of curiosity, not enough skepticism, and the inability to listen to what other people have to say. on top of a lack of research, which obviously our news networks don't help us with. And that is the core of why people don't want to talk politics at the dinner table, is because they just don't want to hear what the other person has to say.
And they don't want to be wrong.
That is the core, the problem American society is facing, I think, is just the lack of refusal to hear. Refusal to hear what the other person has to say. Right. And there's always this idea of like, oh, if I talk to a liberal, if I talk to a conservative, they're going to try and convert me to their other side.
Yeah.
Maybe to an extent, there might be a bit of that. But at the end of the day, like, you should just talk about it, because it's just about having an open dialogue. I know I'm repeating myself and whatever, but you know, people will do all sorts of like mental gymnastics to get to the answer they want to get to, or, you know, they're going to like, you know, get overly stubborn, which is such an embedded trait of American society as well. But
Do you think the lack of conversation affects how or people's understanding of what actually is going on?
Absolutely. Because like I said, our news networks aren't doing us justice. Like, they're not giving us the information that we need. And I don't think people have the curiosity to get online and read multiple articles from multiple news sources. And that is something that I think isn't nurtured enough in the education system, like a lack of curiosity and skepticism. And, you know, pointing fingers at property tax. Like, you know, when you think about it as a kid, most kids are always like, why? Like, why? And where in a person's upbringing do they lose that ability to ask such a fundamental question?
Right. Like,
why? You know?
Yeah. Very good points. Yeah. Well, I mean, if we spend most of our, we spend a lot of time watching the news or reading, you know, various websites telling us what to think, we're going to become entrenched in that particular perspective. And there's this very frustrating dynamic that plays out in our politics where it's like, I identify as Democrat and I identify as Republican. And so we're going to have a conversation, not as two people having a conversation, but as the Democrat and as the Republican, and essentially wearing these masks where it kind of covers up the similarities and all of the things that we do agree on. And earlier, previously, you know, you had mentioned, you know, this division in the country. And I agree to a certain extent that is a real thing. Like, of course, people have different perspectives on the future of the country and, you know, what party should be in power, et cetera. But I think that the news gives the appearance, the news as well as the structure of the political system, the two-party duopoly, gives the appearance that there is this much more deeply entrenched division than there really is. Because at the end of the day, what we really want as humans is all pretty similar. We want to be safe. We want to be loved. We want to give love. We want to spend time with family. We need, you know, food, water, safety, shelter. You know, it's kind of like the basic things ultimately when it comes down to it. And all everything else, all the other political ideology and policies that sit on top of those basic needs tend to obfuscate, you know, some of the more deeply held places and areas that we really are pretty similar on.
Yeah, I 100% agree with you. Like, I fundamentally believe that people want to leave this country knowing that they left it a better place for the next generation. Whether that's the physical environment, the climate, social equality, or like economic growth. Everybody wants to leave the world a better place for their grandkids. Sure. No doubt. And with that shared goal of wanting that, I don't understand why politics are taboo at the dinner table. And like, you know, to me, there's nothing scarier than a person who won't openly talk about their views. like in the closet racists, where that resentment is simmering right under someone's skin. Because the like the first step to truly having a healthy discussion is just being open about it. Like, okay, you want to, you're racist, own it. Talk to me about why, you know?
Yeah.
And like, you know, I'm going to admit like the first step to knowing is admitting you don't know. And that's just the key to say, I don't know. I want to learn. Like how I see things right now in terms of political party, like on the one hand, you have, you know, Democrats, liberals screaming for racial equality. And on the other hand, you have conservative Republicans yelling for economic growth. And, you know, given the history of this country, like race and economics are so embedded, seeing as this country was built on the back of slaves, there's no way to fix one without the other. You can't fix the economy without race, and you can't fix race without the economy. Like, And it you know, it just begs the question of like both of these sides where they are embedded with each other. It just, it makes me fundamentally ask like, who is shaking the pot?
Yes.
Who are the people?
Oh my gosh, yeah.
Who are the people upstairs telling one side and the other, oh, you guys don't get along? But
exactly.
The reality is both are so embedded in the foundation. And the answer is the 644 billionaires controlling 38.5% of America's wealth, according to CNBC. I fact checked.
Hello.
I mean, and like,
someone's been doing their research.
I most definitely have, because a lot of people don't fact check, and I want to make sure I'm not spewing misinformation. And, you know, the article also said by the end of 2021, 1% is going to control 70% of the country's wealth.
Like, that's what we should be afraid of.
And we're here not pointing fingers other. At the other party when we should be pointing upstairs. Like,
because all of us are more close to being in each other's shoes than we are to being in their shoes. It doesn't matter if you make $100,000 a year or $25,000 a year.
Yep.
We're still closer. We're nowhere near being a billionaire.
Yep.
Yeah, I think that's an important perspective. My quick reaction on that is there's still a danger in projecting any class as the enemy, even the billionaire class, because then it's like, then we're in resistance with this other group of people. We're still in resistance. We're making, you know, other fellow humans, you know, the bad guys. And you know, maybe having a bad guy makes the narrative more fun and juicy, and perhaps it's necessary for, you know, the evolution of consciousness, you know, one might argue. But at the end of the day, like even the billionaires, again, like to my point earlier, like they still want the same things that we do. Like they want to have, you know, a happy family. They want to have safety and security. And so when we're like, oh, screw the billionaires, it's, you know, it's still pointing the finger at some other group of people. Even maybe it's like a more accurate, right? As opposed to like, oh, well, it's the Republicans' fault, or oh, it's the Democrats' fault. I don't know. I'm curious what your perspective is on that.
I definitely hear what you're saying, and it is definitely a lot more juicy to have a villain in any sort of narrative. However, I still think that like with the staggering wealth inequality, that just means like that insane inequality translates to political power and therefore the larger political system. So campaign funding, that falls into the category of the power billionaires have.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of that, they push to be able to save the amount of wealth that they get. When at the end of the day, you know, a lot of these billionaires, whilst they did work very smart, a lot of their wealth does come from familial generational wealth.
Mm-hmm.
And that familial generational wealth is because their families didn't pay as much taxes, and that because of that, they push the political party that believes in that. And whilst it is easy to point fingers, I also think because we do live in a capitalist country where everything unfortunately revolves around money, that's where money and power align. Mm-hmm. And that's, and you know, we're the system is too far gone. We're not going to remove money from the account. Like that's just, we're not going to remove money. So unfortunately we have to deal with the cards that we're given. And it just so happens that most of the cards belong to the billionaires and they are not, let me take a second to rethink my point, but,
yeah.
Go on.
I heard an interview and the name is escaping me, and he was a billionaire. Sorry, I can't remember the name. But he was talking about like the problem with wealth and how he could see that it was a problem that like some people hoard wealth and he didn't know what to do about it. But he believed that everyone deserves to have what they need. But he said, unfortunately, the reality is that you're either really wealthy or you're fucked. And I thought that was a really interesting perspective because I get where he's coming from, but I don't think that that's true. And it just made me think about what you were sort of approaching about, like, if you're in their shoes, you're not going to choose policies that are going to affect you negatively. Mm-hmm. But it's also like comprehending the reality. And this took me a long time to get was that like, if some people have so much, it's being taken from others. And that was like, for me as an American, growing up American my whole life, I never understood that until I was an adult. And I always just thought it was like, I was taught, if you are wealthy, you earned it and you know, it was fair and square, and that people who are poor chose that. That's what I was told growing up. And I didn't believe it, but the seed was planted. And it wasn't until I got older and started doing my own research that I realized it's like, yes, it's a tug of war. So like, I feel like it shouldn't have to be that way, but like, how do you expect someone who's winning a tug of war to let go?
Right.
You know, like, it's a conundrum.
It's an absolute conundrum. And here, I'm going to read this stat that I pulled from The Atlantic. More than a quarter of nearly 6 billion contributions from identifiable sources in the last campaign cycle just came from just 31,000 people. So $6 billion in campaign funding only came from 30,000 people, which is one-tenth of the U.S. population. Mm. Children born in 1940 had a 90% chance of doing better than their parents did, whereas children born in the 1980s just had 50% chance of the same. So what this basically means is that the step of the income ladder are just too far apart for people to climb them.
Yeah.
It's not fair. Like, well, nothing is fair in life, but just given the economic structure, like you are born rich, like you will stay rich. You're born poor. Yeah, you can climb the ladder. It'll be much tougher, but the steps are just so large. It's almost, I don't say it's impossible, but the probability of you getting to billionaire status from zero is very low.
Yeah, it's really good that you're talking about that because I feel like in America, the survivorship bias or the one in a million hero story is so huge. And I, like you were saying, like who's at the top pushing these stories on us? I feel like there's an intentional push for that. It's like themes in a lot of our media and our entertainment. But the reality of that is the person who is born into poverty and they're fortunate enough to not have some serious social trauma, some serious familial trauma, having been bounced around from home to home because they couldn't afford to stay in one place. Maybe they went hungry, you know, while they were developing. There's so many things that poverty does to a child that makes it, even if you try to do everything right in the future to bring yourself up, the likelihood that you're going to have the capacity to be able to achieve that is just, the cards are really stacked against that person. And I mean, I don't know, I feel like it's very dangerous to push these narratives. And I'm not saying that those things can't be healed or fixed, but it's a huge investment and it would take, you know, you would have to choose. Are you going to try to get wealthy? Or are you going to try to you know, heal yourself. So it's just, it's very dangerous, I think, to push that narrative onto people who have grown up in poverty and with the trauma of poverty that they've experienced in their lives.
Absolutely. 100%. People love a good underdog story. People live off of that. It's just like, oh, the underdog, they made it. But the reality of the situation, it makes the people at the top feel better about themselves. It's like, oh, if that underdog can do it, then I'm totally okay. Mm. I'm totally fine. I'll just donate a little bit to charity, not pay tax. All good. It's fine. I donated to charity. It's okay. And it's just like, look, at the end of the day, like, again, because we live in such a capitalist system, the major way I see this is moving towards a more equal future is something as simple as a wealth tax. And I know a lot of states are already trying to implement this, but it's just a way to reduce the incentive for the rich to soak up all the cash in the first place. And it makes the steps a little closer together. So we don't end up in a bloody oligarchy, which at the end of the day, like, which America, people came to America in the first place to escape the social class.
Yeah.
To be like, fuck the monarchy, fuck all that, fuck social class. I'm going to come to this new country and pave my way to the top. And what's really happening right now is just we're creating a new kind of financial monarchy.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, anyone can be queen, but you just got to like make a lot of money to get there. Mm. Which is, again, that's a whole other conversation, which is the flaws of capitalism, which I will not rampage on about, but that's really what's happening. So you tax the rich, then you prevent an oligarchy and you prevent this financial fucking monarchy. And then I think everything will be a lot better. But then, you know, the other side of the argument is like, well, you know, billionaires could just be like, fuck off. I'm moving to a different country and I'll take my wealth there. Like, fuck you, America. Like, I'm gone. I'm going to go to Switzerland, open my Swiss bank account or whatever. And it is difficult. It is a conundrum. You know,
it's probably like, be okay if they did. I mean, it might suck for a little bit, but I think we will adjust.
No, we will be totally okay. That's what people don't understand. We will be totally okay. We have this beautiful thing called the federal government, which will help issue states and cities like bonds. Like, yeah, okay, it'll, as you said, it'll suck a little bit, you know, we'll like have to cut some like governmental services, which is honestly already happening, like schools and the healthcare system. But I don't think legislation should be scared of billionaires. And I definitely know that
like there has to be a standard of, I guess, not really, something has to be sacred. There has to be a line that can't be crossed. I feel like government is supposed to function as that, but it's in our country it doesn't. I think in like the Scandinavian countries it kind of does. It sets like a philosophical standard and they say like, this is the type of community we are and we're not going to go outside the lines of that. And there's like a baseline of dignity that we are going to make sure that we stick to. But I feel like in America it's sort of like a free-for-all. It's like we don't really have that as much. And I'm hoping that that's something that the, you know, newer generations of politically active people are going to help bring back, because I feel like ethics and values are way more important to current generations.
Yeah, most definitely. I mean, like you always, it's weird to me that like growing up, my dad would always tell me like, oh, when you make a decision, you especially a business decision or you meet with an investor or whatever, you always got to factor in corruption. Because you can't put that past people. That's embedded in American society. You can't forget that. You can't assume the best. Always assume the worst. And as pessimistic as that is, that's something that I've always really taken. And I just hope, I can only hope that our government cares more about like decaying public services and falling infrastructure over the importance of a singular billionaire, you know?
Yeah, right. Well, right? Hopefully like, they're not friends with them. That would help. But
but you know they
Never
are.
Know.
You,
yeah.
You know they are. You know they are. Which is the,
they're
the
having brunch. They're lunching right now.
They're totally having brunch right now.
Yeah, it's cool. I like how you're thinking about solutions as far as taxing goes. Something I've been interested in learning more about is a value-added tax that they have in Scandinavian countries and many other social democratic countries, where it alleviates like the wealth tax issues related to like retirees, so that retirees aren't taxed on their homes and their, you know, things that they own, and they're no longer working. But it's sort of like creates, and I don't know a lot about this. I need to learn more, and maybe we need a guest on to talk about value-added tax. But what it sounds like to me is it taxes each step of the way along the path of a country's innovation. So any products that get made in that country or any services that are created in that country, the process gets taxed instead of just like manufacturers don't get taxed, then they sell it to people for taxes who tax their customers. It's sort of like there's taxation along the way so that the value of the whatever is being traded in the market increases. And that is a way to generate a lot of income for a country to then use as a base funds to support their social programs and to make sure that the infrastructure stays intact and is developing with new technologies and like new forms of, or, you know, like to basically make the society better, to have funds to be able to do that. And we don't have that. It's just like a race to grab as much cash as you can.
Yeah. I wish I knew more about VAT, but that sounds ideal. That sounds great. Like
more solutions. I think like learning about solutions through our research, just the way we learn about better policies, is really important.
Yeah.
Yeah. Go on. Yeah.
Well, you mentioned the wealth tax earlier, and it makes sense, but I'm not so convinced on that. Like what you mentioned earlier about, you know, people potentially fleeing because they want to avoid the taxes. Like that seems pretty likely. You know, if I imagine myself having millions or billions of dollars, I would do whatever I could to make sure that I keep as much wealth as possible. And I think at the end of the day, like, wealthy people are going to figure out ways to outsmart the government legally or illegally. And simply increasing the tax on them is just like penalizing people for having a lot of money or being successful. Regardless of like whether that's earned or not, that's the way that they're going to view it. And so there's alternatives like a value added tax, but there's the other fact of the government is able to authorize the Federal Reserve to print money ultimately. So as we've seen with the pandemic relief and quantitative easing, they're just like, hey, we need some money. Can you print some money? Sure. So maybe I'm totally missing something, but like, you know, we have needs, right? Like we want to have better infrastructure, better schools, better healthcare. And why can't we just print money for the things we need instead of relying on having to tax people? Like that's just something I don't understand.
I don't know. I think the major point to printing more money is that it devalues the dollar internationally, which causes inflation. And then there's I've only taken one economics class, so I don't know as much detail as an economist. But I don't think that devaluing the dollar is going to help in the long run. Because even so, the people with more dollars are still going to have, it's still not going to fix the issue. Because even you'll have a billionaire and you devalue the dollar, yeah, they'll still be millionaires or whatever, you know? And I do hear your point about billionaires fleeing. And, you know, I don't like my taxes taken as well. Like, nobody does. Like, you work your ass off to have, like, whatever percentage of your paycheck taken. No, I hate it as well. And we're already seeing billionaires flee from, like, you know, California to Austin, Texas, like where new tech is becoming a big thing. Like we're seeing it, especially with after a large amount of state taxes being implemented. But at the end of the day, like, I know I keep saying at the end of the day, it's like a thing. I've noticed I've repeated myself multiple times with that sentence. San Francisco, case in point, still was like one of the wealthiest cities in America. Mm-hmm. The property value is still unreal. Mm-hmm. So no matter how much you tax people, and I know that California is trying to take 3.5% of people who earn more than $5 million, an extra 3.5%, which is honestly nothing. It's pocket change to these people. New York, New Jersey, San Francisco, LA, they're still some of the richest cities in America. You know, like having gone to the South and seeing places like Mississippi and like rural cities, like those states and those cities will still be exceedingly rich.
Yeah. And
these billionaires are not going to suffer any lifestyle changes. You know, whether you go from 10 billion to 1 billion, does that really make a difference at that point? You know?
Yeah. Sure. I don't. And so I'm remembering a point earlier, though, which is like, I don't think it's fair to expect very wealthy people to. What are you? Mm-hmm. This?
Oh, thank you.
Okay.
Also, point, did I say economy class or economics class?
You said economics.
Okay. Yeah. I just, you know, I had a mental bluff. But go on, Cosmo. What were you saying?
So I don't think it's fair to expect super wealthy people to just freely give up their money or like impose more taxes on people and just have them be happy about it. I think if we're expecting, if we're saying that we need more money to improve the American situation, the country, the society, et cetera, then, you know, for various projects or what have you, ultimately, what I think is really needed is a shift in values and priorities on the behalf of the upper class. So it's more of an internal shift in consciousness where it's like where they realize like, oh, you know, I have all this money and people, projects need money to create new opportunities for technology or social programs, etc. And now, granted, you know, there, of course, people donate to charity all the time. So I suppose that's not necessarily anything different. But I don't know. I find it hard to believe the upper class just being stoked about having to pay way more money in there for taxes. Like, I just don't see that necessarily being
absolutely
viable.
Absolutely not. No, we know for a fact billionaires don't want to pay tax. That's why they're, you know, fleeing. Like, you know, it's easy. It's easy to say, let's just tax the rich, eat them up. Fuck it. They have all the money. It's easy. And in an ideal, perfect world, every billionaire is like, fuck yeah, let's do it. Let's all help everybody.
Here's my money.
Yeah, here, take it. I'll remove all your student debt, all your loans, whatever. I'll do it. But, you know, realistically, these are greedy motherfuckers who have had to do a lot of corrupt things to get to where they are today. And to expect them also to just start being charitable and lovely is also very idealistic. So I think it comes down to the fundamental structure of the political system in the sense that, as I was saying, I think it federal governments should be in the case that like the wealth tax doesn't happen. I think federal governments should be issuing more bonds to cities and states. And I definitely think that with that, they need to increase their revenue by unfortunately cutting services, but it's up to whatever we consider the services more important. So right now people are cutting school systems. And whilst that does increase the revenue, do we really want to be cutting education or do we want to be cutting something else that's not as important?
Right. Yeah, I think that education is a huge issue. And like what I think a big problem is that America has valued education less and less and less over the years. And it seems to really be working in the billionaire class's favor because like what we were talking about, everyone hates paying taxes, including people who wouldn't be affected by tax increases, like people who make over $400,000 a year. If their taxes are raised, it's not going to affect someone who makes $35,000 a year. But these are a lot of the people who are voting for the policies that benefit the wealthy and not themselves. And I'm really confused about that because I wonder why they're like, is it a lack of education? Is it manipulation from the media? Is it, what is that? Like, why are people voting against themselves in their best interest and thinking that it is going to be in their best interest?
Yeah, I think it's all of the above. I mean, a lot of public schools here are funded by property tax. So you're in a nicer suburban neighborhood, you'll get a nicer school. And I think that's crap because people in lower income neighborhoods will not get access to better educational systems. And that's why I think one weird, cool benefit about COVID is online classes.
Yeah.
Because it gives people of lower income neighborhoods access to higher education, like, you know.
If they have internet.
If they have internet. And, you know, I mean, that's also one weird side bonus, but I hear you. I mean, manipulation of media, and I think us as filmmakers definitely have a huge responsibility on that end. But yeah, it's again, I think the lack of curiosity and skepticism that's implemented, like that I don't feel is implemented in the education system. Because at the end of the day, like, yeah, you could have a cool academic syllabus where you learn, you know, A, B, C, D or whatever, but you should be teaching kids the value of being able to ask why all the time. And I think I've always believed that skepticism and curiosity is the first step to intellectual thought.
Yeah.
I'm just riding my own high horse here, you know?
No, I agree. And I think it fits well with what you said earlier about people being afraid to talk about politics because they're afraid of being wrong. I think it should be okay to say, I don't know. And I think that would help foster a sense of curiosity or help children retain it, because I think a lot of times the reasons why their curiosity gets squelched is because the teachers don't know the answer to what they're asking. And instead of just saying, like, I don't know, and that being okay, because everyone needs to keep their job, there's that pressure on the teacher to feel like I need to seem like all knowing and very, you know, like I know everything to these kids. And it's not okay to say, I don't know, in our culture sometimes.
Yeah.
And we see that with the government, especially during the pandemic.
Yes. Like, oh my God. Yeah.
We don't necessarily have all the answers when it comes to understanding what's going on with the virus, what the exact solutions are, but the people in the government believe themselves to be in a position where they have to have the answers, even if they don't know. And yeah, you're absolutely right. Like saying, pretending like we have the answers, even though we don't really know what the truth it really is more detrimental versus just admitting that we don't know. And it's that lack of certainty that, because God forbid the government doesn't know, right?
Right.
The government always must know what's going on at all times.
Right. Yeah. And I think that's also just a case in point to the psychology behind why so many people don't listen to science. Because fundamentally, science is admitting people don't know and are out there about to go do the research to figure it out. And, you know, when you have a scientist be like, you know what, I don't know, but I'm going to go do the research, to a lot of people, it's like, well, they don't know. So clearly they're not educated.
Clearly they're an idiot.
We shouldn't be listening to people who don't know. But it's like, don't you want to be able to admit that you don't know so you can find out?
So you can start doing the
research?
Yeah. I was just thinking about it, like NASA, how like, anytime there's a press release from NASA, there's like so much of like, we don't know. We don't know where this is coming from. We don't know what it is. And it's like, everyone still thinks NASA is awesome. So like, why can't we adopt that? Like, why can't we adopt a more scientific approach to what we're doing and in our lives, in every area of our lives?
Yeah, literally research. You come up with a hypothesis, you got to back it up with research, always.
Yeah. And so like, it's like with filmmaking too, like when you're writing a story, you have to do that for every character, for every situation, for every location.
Yep. You got to do your research. There's a funny thing that like in screenwriting, you know, John Truby basically said, there's no such thing as writer's block. It's impossible. The only reason you feel writer's block is because you haven't done enough research into your character. You don't know them well enough. So that's why you don't know what's the next decision they're going to make. Mm. And that's just true with everything, you know, like do your research. And yeah, it's going to be boring to read through a lot of things, but if you really want to know the truth, you have to do it.
Yeah, I'm curious about, you know, so of course, one of the main things that you're up to is producing short films and features and being a filmmaker. How has the coronavirus, the election, like how has that influenced your thoughts on stories and, you know, the kinds of stories that you're interested in telling?
That's a good question. I don't know. I think on a very superficial level, I think a lot of people are going to be writing stories about how they feel isolated and all that. And for the most part, for me, it's like, I want to be able to tell stories that depict human psychology at their worst. Like, I love starting a character at rock bottom because it's really interesting to see what they're going to do when they are at the lowest of the lows.
Yes.
Because no matter how many people complain, it's like, day 15 in day 13 in quarantine, my life is over. It's like, is it really? Do you really know what it's like to be an actual rock bottom?
Is it really?
You know? Yeah. Like, oh, you're in a nice hotel and you're quarantining with like your Peloton and you can't open the windows, God forbid. Like, it's always really like interesting to see like a human being at their worst, like at just absolute rock bottom.
Yeah. Some of my favorite films are like that. Like, I really loved that movie Girl Interrupted. And it starts out with this young girl having a mental breakdown and then she like recovers from it. And then like Limitless, I love that movie. You know, the guy, he's like completely rock bottom. And then he like, yeah, those stories are really interesting too, because I love to see, like you were saying, like what people are capable of when they really have to get creative in their lives.
Mm. Yeah, truly. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is there anything in particular that you're excited about TV, movie wise that you've been following?
In all honesty, no. I think now with like streaming services, everything is so curated for a specific niche audience. Mm-hmm. And people are obviously, you know, looking to escape. So there's nothing quite like really invigorating me right now artistically. I mean, I will say I'm watching The Great British Bake Off because it's just wholesome. It's wholesome. I get to escape reality for a hot second, but am I there? Am I like in it? You know, am I the edge of my seat yelling at the TV? No, I'm like, oh, that's a lovely cake.
Do you know what's so funny is I was going to ask you earlier if you had been around any British people lately. because people in Britain say at the end of the day a lot. And I was like, I wonder if she's been hanging around Brits lately. I wonder if it's that show.
No, I haven't. I mean, I've been FaceTiming my friends in the UK and I went to a British school growing up, but.
There you go. No. Okay. I was like picking up some of that somewhere and then the show too. But yeah, that show is so soothing. I love watching people cook. It's like, yeah, it's like
ASMR.
Yeah. I always flip the letters, but that's awesome. What about like your own stories? Are you writing anything right now? Or are you working on anything that you would like to share? Because I'm super curious about that.
Well, we currently have three features in development, a short film in pre-pro and this other AI tech initiative that I told you guys about as a complete separate thing. In terms of screenwriting projects, I collaborate with other screenwriters because I don't think I'm the greatest screenwriter. I just dictate really great notes and I just tell them to go write it. No, I just don't have like the dictionary to be able to describe events like a great screenwriter would, nor am I really good at writing dialogue. But all those three center around a character at rock bottom and finding their way up, and they're all different genres and they're all very exciting and they're fun. Awesome. The short film that's in pre-pro right now, I'm actually not as involved with, mainly because I'm trying to work on this other AI thing, which as you guys know, I'm trying to automate the development process of filmmaking breakdown. Trying to use natural language processing to decipher an emotional lexicon based on scripts, like a portal where you can imagine this portal. where you have 10 of the best highest grossing action films and 10 of the worst action films. And you drag and drop every single one into this portal. And the AI basically deciphers this graph on the x-axis. It's just the timeline of the script. And on the y-axis, it's positive to negative emotional. And if there are points that are similar between the highest grossing and the worst film, that's a point that's not worth putting into your script.
Wow, cool.
So basically giving data for whether a studio should produce the film or not. But that's
so cool. So it's like
so much research. So not even anywhere close to being able. Yeah.
Precognition for a flop. Avoiding yes. flop.
Yes.
That's great. That's absolutely. Awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
Sounds I think very valuable.
Being able to collaborate with AI is key to keeping the doors open for a lot of the future generation of filmmakers.
That's
not
so
having
interesting.
That bias there
yeah.
is important.
It's so interesting too, because I feel like, man, that could be really useful for a lot of different things too, not just screenwriting, but like a technology like that, that can like map emotional data. That's really cool.
Yep. Yep. Yeah. There's a really interesting article that this guy did it with all the Harry Potter books. He did it manually. So that took a lot of hours. Yeah. Yeah. The dude did it manually. It's insane. Good for him. But he basically broke down all seven books into anger, guilt, happiness, love, positive. He just basically broke all of it down. You could just see it on a graph and you're
Whoa.
Like, ah, fascinating.
Well, what did he learn anything in particular from that? doing that for seven books?
That they all follow the same structure. Every single book follows the exact same structure of where, in what chapter and what page does it get sadder before it gets happier again.
Wow.
Huh.
Yeah.
Interesting. So where does it, if you remember, does it start, like where did, like what's the general pattern?
I wish I had like a iPad to be able to draw this out, but it, the overall, cause every sentiment is a different graph. But overall, I want to say that, like, I'd rather just pull it up because I don't want to misquote anything.
Yeah. It
sounds very interesting, though. It's like the inner workings of story, right? Because there's a reason why, you know, like Avatar or Harry Potter or Star Wars, why those movies in particular are the movies that go on to make billions of dollars and have multiple sequels and have massive merchandising ability, because they follow some core patterns that connect with humans in a way that perhaps other movies and stories don't in the same way.
Yeah. I'm looking at the graph right now. So overall, there's an average of four highs and four lows for every single book.
Hmm.
Wow.
And you cannot have one without the other.
That's what do you mean that you cannot have a high without a low?
What I'm seeing here is that, you know, when something really happy happens, it needs to follow with something extremely sad. And then it needs to be happy
so
again. And then it has
to be on edge in
yes.
some way. Or it's like, oh, just when I think everything is good, something bad happens. So the narrative is
yep.
propelled forward by
yep.
the almost like the duality of like
yep.
good, bad, good, bad, good, bad, good, bad.
Yep. yep.
Interesting. That makes sense.
It's like a map of the
yeah.
emotional roller coaster. It's interesting
yeah.
that like Harry Potter is a great case study for this, especially when you're talking about using natural language processing to do something similar that could be applied to other stories. Because I think about like language and the power of language, and then Harry Potter being about like spells
mm-hmm.
and you say the spell and mm-hmm. it creates something in the universe
mm-hmm.
and so you're sort of like creating a tech that's going to analyze like the magic in how
mm-hmm.
we communicate verbally
mm-hmm.
through
yep.
dialogue
yep absolutely
yeah, good connection. That's a good insight. I like that, right? Because
yeah.
words have power. We create reality
mm-hmm.
with our words.
Mm-hmm.
We are creating this shared reality with us right now on the podcast and the listener, with the words that we choose to use. Mm-hmm. And only those words, right? And we create different emotions and feelings inside of whoever chooses to listen. And you know, we can say very similarly with politics, right? It's like whatever the politicians, however they choose to speak, is going to generate a response in their audience, ultimately resulting in a vote for them to get into power. And then the words that they use in the bills and the policies have tangible effects out in the world. So there's an intimate connection between language and reality. And it is very much a kind of magic, even yes. though maybe, you know, people don't choose to use those words to describe that. I mean, that is what's going on the fundamental level of, you know, Washington, D.C. They are magicians, but they're not in cloaks. They're wearing suits. So it's,
yep.
it's, you know, similar ancient technology, but just wearing a different costume,
absolutely.
Wearing a different face and wearing yep. different terminology.
Yep. Yep. Mm. Definitely feel that. Yeah.
Yeah. Very cool. Cool. We're coming up on an hour. I think we should probably wrap up soon.
Yeah. I got to go check the polls.
This is your way. Yeah.
It's been an hour. I got to check the polls.
Yeah. Got to figure out the polls now. It's been so long. Well, it's been so much fun talking to you.
Yeah.
Like, I just feel like there's so much we can talk about. I want to know a little bit more before we go about your production company. I know you guys have a really great team. I know you have a really talented cinematographer, Kyle Herman, that you work with. What's the name of your production company? Where's the website? How can we keep tabs on what you guys are doing?
Well, we're called West 36 Productions. We don't have a website, unfortunately. Not yet. But we do have a film on Amazon Prime if you want to go watch that. It's called awesome. Irresponsible.
Irresponsible.
It's cute.
I love it.
It's cute. It's like That's a so cool. it's a cute little mother-son relationship.
Oh,
you know,
I love that.
What is contemporary feminism from a male perspective? All that good stuff.
Oh,
yeah.
That's great. That's
yeah,
awesome.
Kyle Herman's my business partner. He's great. He's spearheading a lot of creatives. And thanks for having me. This has been
thank you
great.
For coming. Yeah.
It was really great. I was so nervous in the beginning and now yeah, let's keep talking.
Sure. I know, right? Like, yeah.
Yeah. This
awesome.
Has been wonderful.
Yeah, it's so great to have you.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining and thank you everyone for listening. If you are enjoying this podcast, please share it with a friend. Visit lifeeconomy.com and make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and leave a review as well. We'll be back in a week next Friday with Jürgen Zwe. We'll be talking about interdimensional travel and astral projection. Tiffany, you're going to love that.
Hey.
yes, some very, very interesting ideas and experiences that this guy will share with us. So definitely tune in for that one. Have a wonderful week and we'll see you soon.